Hello and welcome back to Holistic Pet Radio. I'm Amanda. I'm passionate about helping people make better choices for their pets. I blog weekly at holisticpetradio.ca. You can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all under the Holistic Pet Radio name. Also, be sure to check out our pet wellness group, which is Holistic Pet Parents on Facebook. I know there are some other groups with similar names, but ours is just Holistic Pet Parents. That's it. For anyone who does not know, I do also own a pet food retail store called The Bone and Biscuit, and I own the location in Leduc, Alberta. If you're not in the Edmonton area and can't come visit us at our retail store, I do also offer Skype consultations for pet parents around the world. All you have to do is go to the services tab on holisticpetradio.ca for more information. Okay, so moving on to today's topic, which is common questions about holistic pet care. And I asked for your submissions over the last few weeks. I got questions from Holistic Pet Radio people. I got questions from our store audience. Got a lot of great questions. So we did a Facebook Live answering some of these, and I just wanted to put them out there on the podcast so it's easier for people to listen to them on the go rather than sitting and watching through an hour-long video. Hopefully this will not be that long. So first topic is natural flea and tick prevention and deterrence and all that sort of stuff. We're obviously coming into that season, and I think everyone's starting to really think about that, which is a really wise decision. So first of all, I think it's really important to know that there are kind of two ways that you can go about dealing with fleas and ticks. You can deter them, and you can absolutely prevent them. Now, preventions tend to be the more chemical insecticide-based treatments, and absolutely they prevent fleas and ticks. They kill them off, but they're also very serious chemicals, and they do house a lot of serious potential side effects that you should familiarize yourself with. I personally really don't use them with my pets at all, but that's a decision that you need to make on your own and have that discussion with your holistic or integrative veterinarian. Now, I work more with deterrents, and deterrents are generally thought of as a more natural way, and they just reduce your pet's likelihood of having fleas and ticks choose to infest them. It's all about evaluating the risks in your area. I live in a cooler, more northern climate, so I worry about fleas and ticks between spring and fall. Dead of winter, it's like minus 40 here, there's nothing crawling around, we're fine. If you're in Florida, obviously a different situation for you. Also, if you're somewhere like Florida, or even not necessarily that tropical, but even warmer, in general, mosquitoes also are a concern, and heartworm is a concern. For me, in my area, I do heartworm testing every year, and I am not giving a monthly like heartworm preventative. That's a decision I've chosen to make based on the risks that I've assessed for my own pets. I'm not advocating that to anyone, obviously. I think it's definitely a decision to do some research about and talk to your vet about, like I was saying. But I really want to talk about deterrence, what you can use as something you can apply topically to make your pets less desirable to fleas and ticks. That's what we're kind of here to talk about. So how do fleas and ticks, and I have a whole podcast episode about this, by the way. Sorry to cut myself off. That was confusing. Fleas and ticks, I have a whole podcast episode all about flea and tick deterrent, so you can go listen to that, but I'm going to just touch on this because this is a big question that I got. So fleas and ticks find your pet, your dog, your cat, your horse, whatever, using chemoreceptors. And what that means is they use their sense of smell to find them. So knowing that, you just have to modify the way your pet smells, and that can help prevent fleas and ticks from choosing them as host. Obviously, it doesn't mean that they're like never going to get touched by a flea or tick. No one can guarantee that, but it can make them definitely less appealing. So some options you can try: apple cider vinegar works great. It's good for a lot of different things, but even spraying it topically on them will help change that their smell, and you can give it internally as well. Neem oil is really effective, and catnip oil are also very effective. Dr. Becker did a Facebook video all about natural flea and tick deterrence, and she included some of these things in her video. So I trust her recommendations, and I've used them myself, and I've always had really good results with them. I spray them on my horse every year, my dogs, my cats get, they don't really go outside at all. They're indoor cats. So if they are going to go outside with me on a leash, or if I'm supervising them, I still will spray them with a neem or a catnip oil or an apple cider vinegar, but they're not going out in the woods. So I don't worry about my indoor cats as much. My horse and my dogs, though, are more of where I focus my attention. And you can also mix in essential oils into that spray. So things like lemongrass, lemon, geranium, eucalyptus, cedarwood all have good flea and tick and mosquito repelling properties. You will not want to use that mixture on cats, though. There's kind of some debate about how cats handle essential oils. If you're interested in learning more about that, I would recommend checking out Dr. Melissa Shelton's website. She's got Facebook pages. Like, if you just search her name, she'll come up. She's got a ton of info about essential oil use and kitties. and dogs too. The other big note I want to make about flea and tick prevention is that these parasites and insects and all these different creepy crawly different things are opportunistic, and they will always, always go for the weakest animals in the herd. So giving your pet a very healthy, strong immune system, that is the best prevention you can do. It's going to help them from becoming completely infested, even if they do have like one or two. I've had foster dogs come in covered in fleas, and my dogs maybe will get like one or two, but they never become infested. Same with ticks, like same with worms, all these sort of things. Healthy immune systems help your pet fight all sort of external factors off much more effectively. So feeding them whole fresh food is really great. Giving them probiotics, boosting their immune system, minimizing the vaccines, definitely making sure they have protective immunity, but not over vaccinating them. These are all things you can do to really help boost that immune system. Also, interestingly enough, if you're feeding kibble all the time, even just adding in some whole fresh foods, especially raw meat in a balanced way, ideally, obviously, meat, bone, organ. But the raw meat itself is a really great source of B vitamins, and fleas and ticks actually don't like the taste of B vitamins. And that is why people use brewer's yeast as a flea tick deterrent, but feeding whole fresh food actually might be more effective than that. And also, brewer's yeast is pretty allergenic, and I see so many dogs with allergies that I don't generally recommend this. Feeding yeast can, a brewer's yeast can just spur on yeast growth, and it's pretty allergenic. So like I was saying, I don't necessarily recommend that, but to each their own. Next, I'm going to quickly talk about dewormers and diatomaceous earth and some other options you have. Now, I am planning to do a whole podcast all about dewormers, but to quickly address one question I got is, can you and should you use diatomaceous earth as a dewormer? So for anyone who doesn't know what diatomaceous earth is, it is basically a powdery substance made up of sedimentary rock that contains the fossilized skeletal remains of diatoms. Diatoms are unicellular algae, and they consist, they make up a lot of the phytoplankton in the ocean. So they're basically, at a molecular level, they're sharp, they're damaging to the exoskeletons of different creepy crawly animals. However, worms obviously don't have exoskeletons, and so the way it functions is to damage the exoskeleton, and that whatever it is, flea, tick, mite, whatever, will, once their exoskeleton is damaged, they lose moisture and they'll dehydrate and die. Worms don't have exoskeletons, and when diatomaceous earth becomes wet, it's actually less effective. So it's probably not your best option for a dewormer. I know that in the horse world, people like to use it sometimes, and other people kind of will use it for dogs. I don't recommend it. If you are going to use any sort of diatomaceous earth around your pet at all, always make sure it's food grade, and you never want them inhaling it, and you don't want to be inhaling it either, because it is aggravating. Obviously, that's how it damages exoskeletons. It's aggravating to the lungs as well. So my recommendation and what I use with my pets is herbal-based dewormers. So I've used these with really great success. I fecal my horse every year. She's always had really good results. We do the dewormer spring and fall. There's a lot of different options out there. You can use liquid dewormers that are herbal tinctures. You can do just dried herbs and remedies like that. I know there are homeopathic dewormers out there. Personally, haven't used those, but I do know some people have had good success with those. Basically, the way my schedule is, I do deworming, herbal-based deworming, twice a year, spring and fall, with my dogs, my cats, my horse. Everybody gets it. Same time, we do a liver cleanse. We do a milk thistle-based liver cleanse, and we do deworming. Quick note about a new test that I learned about. It's called 4DX testing. Dr. Becker was talking about it on that Facebook Live that I mentioned. And basically, it's a heartworm test, but it is also a test for tick-borne and flea-borne illnesses. So it can actually show you if there's an infection or if your pet's immune system has worked the way it should and fought off that disease. Just a small note of caution with doing that test, though, you do want to make sure you have a vet who knows how to read those tests, because you don't want them to give antibiotics unless there's actually sign of infection, not just exposure, because exposure doesn't necessarily equal infection. Your pet's immune system could have functioned properly and they could not have an infection, but it's kind of an interesting option. I was just previously doing like basic heartworm testing, and I'm going to start requesting a 4DX test moving forward. So I just thought it was something interesting that I would pass along. Next, I got a question about ear cleaning, which is a really interesting one to me, because I, for those of you who don't know, grew up with basset hounds, and every summer we would go out to our cabin and spend the whole summer out there. So we had two floppy-eared basset hounds who were, when I was very young, were fed kibble, spending time at the lake. So we did a lot of ear cleaning. I learned to clean basset hound ears very, very young because they stink. We did eventually obviously switch them to raw when I was around 9 years old, but before that, they were very stinky. I do remember that just smell that they had. But my point with that is that I understand the pain of cleaning floppy-eared dog ears. Big point with this is basically you have to tailor ear cleaning to your dog's needs. Right now, my three girl dogs really don't need ear cleaning that often. They aren't like flopped over ears. I have mixed mutts. Two of them have very pointy ears and the other one has like slightly floppy ears, but she's still getting a lot of airflow. So they don't, I will check their ears, you know, a couple times a month, and they don't really need to be cleaned. Like, I've really never had to clean their ears. They function the way they should and they self-clean. But with floppy-eared dogs or dogs who are swimming all the time, sometimes we need to do a little more general maintenance. Like, you might have a dog who needs their ears cleaned every single day. When we had Basset Hounds, even raw-fed Basset Hounds, they still needed their ears done, you know, 4 or 5 times a week. Just kind of the nature of those dogs. So I think that's the first note about natural-based ear cleaning or even any type of ear cleaning. Different dogs need different care schedules. So you might have one dog who needs their ears done, you know, every month, never needs them done. One dog who needs them done every day. So tempering to that, number one. Next thing, you want to look for things that are astringent and kind of drying, but are more natural. So like witch hazel is a really good one. You can look for things like gentian violet. It's really nice and antifungal. A lot of the times ear infections come on when yeast starts growing in the ear. There's a lot of other causes, but yeast is a big culprit in ears in my experience. So apple cider vinegar, really, really great. Solution 50-50 with water. Cotton pads, scrub in the ear, like gently scrub in the ear, but that's a really good way to keep it under control. It's honestly, in my opinion, it's really about maintaining as much as your pet needs. Also, if there's some irritation, you can use things like calendula tea. You can brew dried calendula flowers, or you can also do chamomile tea. A lot of people have that on hand. That's nice and anti-inflammatory, so you can try that as well. Next, I got a question about variety and raw feeding. So someone asked during our Facebook Live, how many different proteins should you be feeding? How often should you be rotating? All that kind of stuff. My general rule, and this was a great question, and it's a question I get a lot. I think it's a question raw feeders are always discussing. I am always an advocate of the more variety you can give your pets, the better. So it all depends on your own budget, your freezer space, what's available in your area, you know, all these different things. And obviously, if your pet has allergies, that also becomes a compounding factor. But let's just pretend your pet doesn't have, you know, major allergies. You're not working with like, oh, I know my dog can eat one protein right now. Let's talk about the majority of dogs who can eat multiple proteins. I strive for, you know, rotating between at least 4 or 5 proteins before my dog ever gets the same protein again. The more you can do, the better. Obviously, owning a pet food store, I have access to a lot of different proteins. So my pets get, you know, goat, bison, duck, llama, rabbit, kangaroo, wild boar, like they get a lot of different proteins and not necessarily everyone has access to this. General rule, 50-50 red and white meat. So a split at least. You really want to be focusing on getting some red meat in there because I know chicken is a cost-effective protein and I have nothing against chicken, but I feed it as minimally as possible to my dogs. My dogs realistically very rarely get chicken, but I know that's not a reality for everyone. So at the very minimum, I advocate for 50-50 red, white split. Obviously, we're talking about raw feeding right now, but if you are feeding kibble, rotating in some raw is a really great option. If you're feeding a chicken-based kibble, try rotating in some other proteins or try other proteins in your kibble and rotate in some chicken raw because that is going to be your most cost-effective option. Variety is really important. Also, I usually strive for 5 different proteins and 5 different organs is the other. So there's a couple rules. They're not rules, but guidelines, let's call them. 5 different proteins, 5 different organs, 50-50 red-white split. That's in a like a small summary. That's what I recommend for rotation and variety. That's really important. Wolves in the wild have been documented with up to 38 different foods in their stomachs at one time. And I mean, that's obviously a little excessive for the traditional like house pet. But the point is that balance comes with variety. Balance comes in variety. One food for the rest of your pet's life, whether it's kibble or raw, is not balanced, in my opinion. They need different foods. I know that the micro and macronutrients supposedly are balanced when you're feeding a kibble that meets AFCO standards, but I really, really advocate and I urge everyone to rotate your pet's brand of food, whether it's commercially prepared raw, you're making home raw, whatever, rotation variety, really, really important. I also got a question about balancing micronutrients in raw feeding, which I find very interesting. I'm currently doing the raw feeding specialist, whatever, Dogs Naturally course, and I'm working my way through it slowly. I'm also doing the acute canine herbalist course, I believe it's called. So, and then I'm also doing this, and I'm running the store, and I have an 8-month-old, so I'm a little busy, but I'm working my way through it. I, like, once a week I'll try and sit down and, like, maybe get through one module, so it takes me a while, but really interesting. But anyways, been learning a bit about the micronutrients. I saw Dr. Becker speak about a month and a half ago in BC, and that was amazing, and she talked a lot about micronutrients. So I'm just going to tell you, kind of summarize what I learned from her in that talk, some of what I heard. If you want to hear the whole talk, it is available on Facebook, on Red Dog Blue Cat's Facebook page, and her whole talk is on there. It's like an hour long, but it's really, really interesting. I think she called it raw feeding 2.0. Basically, for more advanced raw feeders, these are some things you can start to worry about. This is not something I would stress to a first-time raw feeder. Yes, balance and variety is important, but let's focus on getting your pet on a balanced raw food first, and then we can worry about the micronutrients once you're a little more comfortable feeding. Because if you throw this, in my opinion, if you throw this at someone who is just getting started in raw feeding, it could be a little overwhelming. First, let's talk about manganese. Manganese is really important for connective tissue health. So think CCLs, your cranial cruciate ligament. So kind of like our ACL. But how many dogs do you know that have torn or ruptured their CCLs? So many dogs. I see so many dogs who've done this. And usually they blow one and then they blow the other within a year, because I think it's over 54% blow the other leg within the 2 years after their first, like, surgery, if they get TPLO for it. Over 54% blow within 2 years. So not great rates. So manganese, I think, is really important. And the reason I think a lot of pets are lacking manganese, whether we're raw feeding or not, is it's because manganese is, like, highest concentration in fur, feathers, and wool. There's not that many raw foods out there that are containing fur, feathers, and wool. And a lot of raw feeders aren't feeding these things. I think now it's becoming more common as people are really diving into, you know, personalized nutrition for our pets. And we know that, okay, I have a dog that is predisposed to CCL. My breed is predisposed, whatever. My dog was spayed young, so they're probably going to be more predisposed to CCL. Their ligaments are not going to be as strong. People are starting to move towards these things, but I think it's really good to talk about it even more, be aware of it. So how can you get manganese into the diet? A lot of different ways. Obviously, adding fur, feathers, or wool. If you have access to it, that's great. Fur, you can do, like, whole dehydrated rabbit's feet and ears. I do that with my pets. It took them a while to get used to eating them, but now that they do really well in those. You can also feed mussels and oysters. I always advocate for cooked oysters. So I am kind of lazy. I don't want to cook the oysters myself. I also don't really like the smell of them. So I do canned oysters packed in water, because those will be pre-cooked. And you can also do ginger. And these are all from Dr. Becker's talk, these recommendations. So like I said, you can check that out on Facebook if you want to. Iodine is the next thing that your pet could be lacking potentially. And iodine has all to do with thyroid function. And Jean Dodds, I've talked about her book before, but it's great, The Canine Thyroid Epidemic. She talks about how the thyroid gland is probably responsible for a ton of issues that we don't even link it to in pets right now. Aggression, behavior issues, chronic immune system deficiencies, like a ton of different things. And her book is really great. It's linked on my blog already, so you can check that out or just search for it on Amazon. It's The Canine Thyroid Epidemic. But how do we supplement iodine? You can add things from the sea, basically kelp. Although, special note with kelp, you will want to look for kelp. I did a podcast all about kelp. You'll want to look for a kelp with a standardized iodine content, because not all the ones on the market do have iodine in it. Dulse, which is a type of seaweed, and foods from the ocean, like I was saying, like oysters and mussels are a really great option. Next up is zinc. Zinc is related to coat quality, poor coat quality if you have a zinc deficiency, hair loss, lethargy, weakened immune system, and zinc is found in highest concentrations in teeth. And again, there's not a ton of foods and or raw feeders who are including teeth in their grind. So that's why maybe there could be some zinc lacking in the diet. To get more zinc in, you can add raw green tripe, or canned oysters packed in water are a really good source. And then lastly, I just wanted to touch on vitamin E. It's a really beneficial antioxidant. It fights free radical damage. and it can be found in pumpkin seeds, spinach, and other leafy greens. And if you are feeding kibble currently or a raw food with fish oil added into it, and you'll want to check your ingredients for that because surprisingly, a fair few do add things like salmon oil into their formulas. The problem being that, and I've talked about omega-3s before a ton, but they are very unstable polyunsaturated fatty acids. And so what happens is the bonds will break down when they're exposed to air or heat. So especially for kibble, they're really not present in a useful way in the long run. So basically once kibble is processed, it's like the omega-3 content is nil and they're actually rancid. And the problem is that the when your body ingests rancid fish oils, omega-3s, anything like that, fish oils are omega-3s, but when your body ingests these rancid oils, it will actually take from its own store of vitamin E to help stabilize those oils. And then your body is using up its store of vitamin E. And so it can't go out and do that antioxidant fighting free radical damage work. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So if you are feeding kibble, make sure you are supplementing or raw food with a fish oil in it or anything like that. Just supplement extra vitamin E in the diet. So pumpkin seeds, spinach, leafy greens. If you are feeding a bottled fish oil, look for one with vitamin E in it. Okay, so I hope you guys found that helpful. I just kind of wanted to go over some common questions that I get all the time, whether through the podcast stuff or through the store. And they're great questions, and I think it's important we talk about it. If you have any questions you would like me to answer, please shoot me a message on Facebook or just join our Holistic Pet Parents group, and you can ask me questions on there. And if you are lucky or if you would like, I would be happy to include them in the show. I am totally willing to put questions at the beginning of the show before we do certain topics. I'm kind of down for whatever. Just let me know what you would like to see moving forward. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, all under Holistic Pet Radio, to chat with me there. And I will see you guys next week. Bye. Oh, I did forget to mention I'm doing another Facebook Live May 6th with Alicia from Riva's Remedies over on the Bone and Biscuit LaDuke Facebook page, but it will be shared on the Holistic Pet Radio page. So if you have any questions about homeopathic and herbal treatments and dosing and all that sort of stuff, she's going to be talking all about that, and I'm super excited. So I hope you guys tune in. It will be 6 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, May 6th. Disclaimer, the contents of this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for professional veterinary advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your veterinarian with any questions you may have regarding the medical condition of your pet. Never disregard professional advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this podcast.